Okay, today we're going to start looking at attention. So this week we'll all be talking about attention. But before I start, one of the things that you need to do as a class is you need to nominate a representative, a student representative for the class that will take part in the various meetings with the informatics teaching organisation. So I'll say that to you now. Think about it during the lecture. Think about whether you might want to be the rep for the class or nominate someone else for it. And at the end of the lecture, then we'll see if we can get a rep. You are allowed to self-nominate on these things, by the way. But the I can't remember exactly how often the meetings are, but the department takes pretty seriously feedback from students about the courses. So there'll be reps there from the other informatics first and second year and other years courses. Is any of you a rep for another class already? Or for informatics one? No, okay. I think also the Students Association, if you're a rep, gives you training on it, and also it's something you can put on your CV. Okay, so we're gonna talk about attention. So we previously looked at vision and particularly visual perception. And later on, we'll go on and look at memory, but we're going to talk about attention. We'll forward reference a little bit of the memory stuff, but not spend much time on it. So attention, what is attention? What does it mean to attend to or pay attention to something? If we look at definitions of attention, then in a lot of cases you have, you know, English words that you use that mean something quite different or maybe much looser in everyday use than when you actually look at the definitions, the more scientific definition, as in the case here, attention in psychology or cognitive science. So the common use definition is to attend, that is a verb, to direct the mind or observant faculties, to listen, apply oneself, to watch over, administer, wait upon, follow, frequent, and that's more the attending to, being an attendant, to wait, expect, or to wait for. Attention is the action, fact, or state of attending or giving heed, earnest direction of the mind, consideration or regard, the mental power or faculty of attending. So you actually have a broad, you know, several different definitions there, none of them terribly precise. But particularly the thing to notice there is we treat this in everyday English as something that we can use, something we can apply. We can attend to something. It's an active thing. So we need to think about what we actually mean in terms of cognition. What does it actually mean there? So two textbook definitions suggest more of what it actually does. So attention means, and this is from the Goldstein book, which is a visual perception book. So some of the chapters in this will be what we give you as well. There's the one main chapter, chapter 6, is the background reading for this bit of the course. The other book, that the textbook that we'll use in relation to memory, also has some sections in it that will be background reading for this course. If you look at the webpage in terms of what the readings are for attention, then you'll see there's a bunch of readings. In fact, what we've done, that's last year's. I'll put the revised version up. The main difference is we've moved a few things from essential reading to background reading. Okay, so it means you have slightly less that's essential reading to read for this bit, but it's still there. So in the Goldstein book, it says, attention means devoting cognitive resources to specific features of the environment in such a way that causes those features to become more deeply processed. So it's explicitly about the purpose of it is then those things you attend to, you will process more deeply. You know, there will be more of an issue about what you interpret from them, perception issue, they'll probably end up in memory, whatever. And Ward, 2008, says, attention is the process by which organisms select a subset of available information on which to focus for advanced processing and integration. So both cases, it's acknowledging there may be a whole bunch of stimuli, but you do not attend to them all. You select what to attend to, and what you select to attend to gets more deeply processed than those other things. It doesn't mean that some of the other stimuli in the world you're not entirely attending to, but you may not be focusing on them to the same extent, and that means you may not be processing them as deeply. So both of these, there's the crucial concepts, as I said. Attention is selective. One of the many available items of features, we can't process everything at once in what we see. We may perceive it, but we don't choose to process everything. And we have to decide what to select in the scene that we process. And that's one of the things that we'll talk about, what might help us determine what we process. The other thing is that we can influence attention both what we might call top-down and bottom-up. That is, top-down will be based on cognitive factors, what we are actually looking for. Bottom-up may be determined by the stimulus factors, and again, we'll say more about this. What is it about that stimulus in the environment that caused you to attend to it? If we attend to a particular item or feature, because we're more deeply processing it, we have a higher cognitive cost. That is, it puts a greater load on us in terms of processing. So we attend to it, as we said, more deeply and in greater detail. And a large part of attention is about integrating information. So the reason we're processing something we see, if we see a bunch of things, we attend to one of them, the reason we focus on that one and the reason we process it is we want to have more knowledge of it, more internal representation, perhaps the cognitive load will be higher. This also, as well as relating to visual perception, this also relates to memory. Both ways, in that if you know of something, if you have a memory of something, then it may also cause you to focus on something or more likely to attend to it. So when we look later on at memory, in a few weeks' time, we'll look at the Baddeley-Hitch model of working memory. And that actually has as part of its model what it calls an attentional controller. This they talk about in terms of how it direct selection, that is, which information should be manipulated and stored in memory. So obviously, you're not going to remember something unless you attend to it. If you see it and then choose to attend to it and then process it, it can end up in memory. So that is one aspect of it, the role of memory in making that happen. The other issue is about how information moves between modules. So if you have different modules in your, you know, different aspects in your brain, then how they relate to each other. But I said, well, come and talk about that and how it relates to attention when we look at the memory unit. So I'm not going to talk about that just now. Okay, in terms of selectivity, we have what you might call a central executive. And if you have various modules that are involved in storing information, it helps coordinate them, it directs. So clearly perception's involved, memory's involved, attention's involved. And this may also interact with other areas of cognition. So if we're then explicitly directing our attention to a particular object or to a particular task, that is making a conscious decision to select the focus of our attention, that's going to involve various different cognitive modules. Therefore, we have to have some way of coordinating that, which is what we talk about as a central executive. If we decide to switch attention between tasks, now it may be the case some of the time you have your attention focused on one task, one object. Frequently, there are occasions where you split that. You know, you decide I'm going to do two things at once. You know, you might be in a lecture and you're finishing off writing notes for some other bit of an assignment that you hadn't done earlier, or you listening to a conversation with someone, but at the same time, you're working out what's going on in the background in order to decide whether you need to switch to that. If you're missing something, something of interest, you can be watching television and doing many other different things at the same time, where you may have your attention being shared between more than one task. So it's frequently the case you may choose to divide your attention between multiple tasks. And again, it's the central executive that will be enabling you to do this. One thing that's interesting, if you talk to different people about how well they do these things, you know, I have friends that really do not like me trying to, when they're doing something, to talk to them and have them do something else at the same time. They don't like doing the multitasking that would require. Other people are very happy to do that. You can have a conversation while they're typing an email and at the same time, you know, listening to music. You know, they can do all three at once. They have no problem with it. But individuals vary on this. You know, check out with your various friends which ones of them get really annoyed when they're doing something and you try and have a conversation and they cannot manage it. They just really want you to shut up and they want to focus on that task. And then they'll talk to you separately. Other friends will be quite happy to do that. They'll say, no problem, I'm, you know, writing this email, I'm doing this. Yes, I can talk to you at the same time. I can split my attention here between several different things and I don't have a problem with it. It's one of the things we'll come back and look at cases where this doesn't work well, where, for example, if you have a person that has an autistic spectrum disorder, one of the things that characterizes that disorder is a problem with central executive functioning. So frequently, and we'll come back and talk about this in another context as well, they will have a problem with that. They may frequently, it may be necessary for them to do one task after another in a particular order and to keep their focus of attention on that. And if you then try and get them to focus on something else or get them change the order in which you do things or the plan that you have to do things, they may get very distressed. And they're getting distressed because they can't cope with it. And the reaction, therefore, is they may get over aroused, they may get upset. And what you may even find is you have upset them way more than you might have expected, but it's because of their cognitive functioning that they can't necessarily do something that you might say someone that's neurotypical would be more likely to be able to do. So we'll come back and mention that briefly later rather than talk about now. But so these relate to, central executive relates to things like planning. You know, again, some people are very good at replanning. You're doing something, it goes wrong or something changes, they can easily replan and continue. Other people can't. Other people have to stick to the plan or explicitly change the plan in a way that means it's very clear. So these things all relate to that. If you have damage to the prefrontal cortex, then these sorts of functions tend to get, people have problems with them. And again, it's something we might look at a bit later. Okay, so what do we mean when we say attention is selective? As we said, we can't process everything. It's all too much, and it's not equally important. You know, we do have to determine what's important and then work out how to focus on that. So, you know, there's the classic examples. You're in a room, you're in a pub, it's crowded, you're talking to your mate. The fact is, there is many, many other conversations going on around you. There are many other stimulus. The telly may be on. There may be a fight in the corner, you know, whatever. You've got a whole load of stuff going on, but you still manage to focus on your friend, your conversation, and to process that. You know, you are able to attend to that specifically. And it's as if, almost as if, nothing is happening. Again, people vary on how well they do this. You may have other friends that, when they're focusing on a task, you can't get their attention. You know, they're very much focused, selective, and you can stand there and say all sorts of things about them, and they won't actually hear them, because they are just someone who doesn't bring in, they don't pay attention to the peripheral stuff. Now you can think of it as, you know, that's a good thing because they're very good at focusing. It's not such a good thing because there may be something going on outside that maybe they should be attending to as well that they're missing. You know, both those, you know, have merits. And you might think yourselves at different times, when you get completely engrossed in something, how, you know, things can fall down around you, you just wouldn't notice. Anyway, so even if you're playing, you know, you've got music playing, other conversations, you have no problem following what your particular friend is saying. Anyway, so this ability, people generally talk about the ability to follow a particular auditory thread whilst cutting out others. It's referred to as the cocktail party effect. And obviously, we don't have many cocktail parties these days, but in 1958, when, you know, this research was done, that would be atypical. You know, it would be more like to say the pub effect these days. Okay, attention makes it possible to use to selectively focus and ignore other things. So what you're also doing there is you're filtering out the irrelevant stimuli. It doesn't mean to say you're not aware of it. You may well be aware of it, but you're actually selectively choosing not to attend to it. There may be contexts where if someone asks you a question about it, you can answer it even though you didn't realize you weren't explicitly attending to it. So you may be getting some processing at some level, but not as deeply as the thing that you're focusing on, that you're attending to. And this can apply to all our sensory modalities. You know, it can apply to, you know, primarily, I guess, to, you know, to vision and to auditory, because they're the ones we mostly use for the high level processing and for gives in information. So in relation to vision, whilst our overall perception of the world, it tends to be, we tend to think of it as being complete, you know, fairly detailed, you know, assuming we can see, then we assume we are seeing everything. But this also, you know, is an illusion. We have, you know, as we said before, we have a very small area where we have the highest visual acuity. That is where we best focus, where, for example, you know, the cells that are there are helping us to process more anything we see that falls on the fovea. When we are attending to something, we tend to look directly at it. So in terms of visual attention, we look directly at it because we will be able to see it better by doing so. There may be other things in the periphery of our vision that we are not seeing as clearly, that we will not be attending to as clearly. So the peripheral vision that we have has less acuity, that is, it's less sharp, it's less defined, and in fact is actually blurry, and it tends to be that that's not where we're focusing. So the physiology of our eyes helps support the focus, the choice to attend to a particular area, to a particular object, to a particular task. One thing we do all the time, and sometimes you may not be aware how much you're doing it, is we also move our eyes in small ways. We may look at one area, but our eyes may not be totally still and fixed on that area. In fact, if you look at one area continually and don't move your eyes, then what happens? Do you keep the same focus, or does it actually eventually disappear? I mean, a classic example, you're reading a book, you're really not getting into it, you're tired, whatever, and you're looking at the book and you're reading the page, and then you realize you are not actually taking any of that page in at all. You know, you really are not, you may be looking at it, but you're really not attending to it. So even though you're looking at it, you still have to think about what's going on. In terms of scenes, when we're looking at a scene, we may often fill in detail because we aren't looking at the whole thing and attending to the whole thing at one go. So often we may fill in external detail on the basis of what we expect to be there. And one of the things we'll talk about a bit later is how we can end up missing things that we should see because of this, because we tend to assume what we're going to see. And if something happens that we're not expecting, if it's not what we're attending to, we may not even notice it. It may be, you know, it may seem, if you ask people, will they notice? They'll say they will. If you then do it to them where you show them something in the periphery that they're not expecting, you may find they don't notice. But I said, we'll talk about that in more detail probably on Thursday. Okay, so our representation of what's in scenes in terms of the depth and the detail and the content is also influenced by our attention to the particular features, tasks, whatever in that scene. Most of the scene, we don't have a lot of detail. It's minimal. But some areas, the areas which we attend to, are more deeply processed as a result of attention. What we may have in terms of how we represent this is, some people talk about this in terms of having a schema, that is an integrated piece of knowledge about the world. So an example would be, what we're talking about here is how we structure and organize our knowledge in the world about things we know about the environment, about events, about what tends to go on. We take in information, we build structures, and from those structures we have expectations, and they help us perceive the world. And they also, when we're trying to do things like fill in the gaps in what we see because we weren't attending to everything, they help us organize that. One of the reasons we want to do that is we want to make predictions about the world. You know, when you're moving around, you want to be able to move in safety. You don't want to walk into objects. When you're doing all sorts of things in the world, it's about what expectations you have, what predictions you can make about what's going on in the world, what knowledge you have that enables you to make those predictions such that you can function. So when you have things that violate a schema, you may find, actually, you may remember them better, they may be more salient, because they violated a schema, because they violated your expectations, if you notice them. So for example, you go into a restaurant, there's a particular script for what you do. You know, typically, you'll go in, you'll wait, you'll get a table, you'll sit down, you'll be asked if you want something to drink, you look at the menu, you know, you'll go through all these things. And this will effectively be a schema for going to a restaurant. And because you have that schema, because you have that in, you know, you have that knowledge as a structure, then what happens in a restaurant will be conditioned by that, and you will have expectations accordingly. So if you go into a restaurant and you're given instead of giving the menu, someone gave you the television guide for that day. Okay, you may even take a second or two to realize, you're looking at it and you're going, you know, why is that what I'm looking at here? Initially, you may not even spot it because you're expecting and you're focusing on getting a menu. You would then notice it and you would remember it because it was out of the ordinary. Another example, in particular buildings, you know what to expect. You know what to expect to go in a hospital. If you look at any movies, then you see that how you use that information to fool people. For example, you know, the typical scene where you've got the baddie who goes into the hospital dressed as a doctor, no one notices him. You know, because he's dressed as a doctor, you expect to see doctors. Therefore, if someone's dressed as a doctor, you assume they're a doctor. You don't ever think about what else they might be or what else they might be there. Okay, schemas allow us, by having this representation of what we might expect in a particular context, they allow us to fill in information that we don't actually take in, that we don't necessarily attend to. So that then enables us to reason about where we are, about the situation, to draw inferences and to make predictions. I'm not going to talk a lot more about schemas here because that again relates more to the representations and the storage of those in relation to memory. So we'll come back to that more when we talk at memory, but if you're interested, look ahead to the Badley memory text for more on that. Okay, so going back to attention about determining, so we've said that you will tend to attend to particular stimuli in the world and not others. But one question is, how do you determine which stimuli is relevant? You know, what's actually pertinent at that point for you in that context? So you've basically got two mechanisms working at any one time on this. You have top-down attention, which is endogenous attention, and you will never be asked to say that that's what it is or remember that it's called that. Top-down attention is fine. This is where your attention is being driven by your knowledge, by your goals, where you're choosing to focus on something consciously. You're choosing to look for something or find something in the environment. So you go into a pub and you're looking for your friend and you're looking for their face and you're listening for their voice and you're doing that top down because you have a model of them somehow in your head that you're trying to match to. So you're going and looking for that top down driving your attention, or you go and look at a bookshelf, you want to find a book, you're looking for that very specific book. And what you tend to focus on for top down, obviously it would depend on what the goal is, what the task is. What is your purpose in that environment at that point in time? What are the options? You know, what did you walk into there for? That will drive what you attend to. Bottom up attention is when your attention is driven by the stimulus. That is, something happens in your visual field that causes you to move. So if someone at the back dropped a book, it would be very likely a lot of you will turn and look that way. You will look to see. Or if someone came in the door, slammed it, said something out loud, that will be a stimulus that isn't currently in your attention that will cause you to change your attention away from me to that particular stimulus. In terms of what things do work well at capturing our attention, movement, flashing objects, bright colours, loud sounds, but also things that are meaning. So they're actually what you might think of strong stimuli or changes in stimuli. And if you actually think in terms of, you know, how we development and what we've previously said about things like, you know, the frog, then the reason may be because there is a change that may be impinging on us in some way that we need to be alerted to. You know, it could even be, you know, relating to the fight or flight response, you know, something is intruding, we need to pay attention, but it's a fairly low level thing. But also we may have stimuli that capture our attention that relate more to our memory and our knowledge, such as a human figure or face, will usually be something that captures your attention. You know, if you're watching a movie and the scene changes and a new scene comes up, you are most likely to attend to the faces in that scene, to the people. Now, having said that, again, when we come to look at what happens when this doesn't work in the expected way, if you look at people with autistic spectrum disorders, they may not respond in the same way to a human face as someone that's atypical, sorry, that's a neurotypical adult. And there are all sorts of theories and reasons why that may, which we'll say something about later when we come to that. Okay, so in terms of it being stimulus driven, there are attentional biases or predispositions to attend preferentially to some stimuli over others. We'll talk about this also more later about attentional bias and what sorts of things you might be likely to shift your attention to coming from, you know, the world or the environment as an object. Okay, I'm going to show you a figure. And in this figure, there are a bunch of bars. And one of them is the odd one out. And what I want to do is simply look at the figure. So I am actually, you know, priming you to look at this. As soon as you see the odd one out, just stick your hand up. Okay? You all ready? It's harder than you think. It took me a while. Okay, some of you still haven't got it. Okay, at this point, you could talk to other people and ask them and work it out which is the odd one out. Well, once someone points out to you, it's like, ah, yes. Okay, have you all got it now, or are some of you still? Okay, I'll tell you anyway to put you out of your misery if you're still trying to find it. So, actually, the odd one out there is, if you look at all the red bars, there was one red bar that has a different orientation. Whilst most of them tend to go that orientation, there's one that goes that way. Okay? But because they're not all exactly the same orientation, it doesn't make that obvious. And the green ones tend to all go the other way, either vertical or slightly that way. The red ones are all slightly that way, and it's the red one that goes the other way that you're trying to find. Okay? And that wasn't as easy as you thought it was going to be, I think. So the one that's the odd one out is the odd one out because of the conjunction of its features. That is, it wasn't because of the way it was facing, because the other ones, the green ones, were facing that way. It wasn't because though it was red, there were other red ones. It was because the only red one facing the other way compared to the other red ones and the green one. Okay. So what you had to do is scan it pretty much almost item by item. When you looked at it, none of you put your hand up straight away. So not one of you did it jump out at you and you went straight away, I can see it. What happened is you looked at it and then you thought, should give us the wrong example here. Is there really an odd one out? Okay, maybe I better have a look more carefully. You know, what are the features there? I'm going to have to look at them every one right across till I find one. So what you may have found is what you're doing there often is a serial search. You're having to just look at every single one. Finding your friend's face in a crowd, similar sort of thing. You're looking to find them amongst a whole bunch of other people. If I give you another couple of examples and give you the same thing, then see how quickly you find these. Well, you've got both of them, stick your hand up. Okay. Almost everybody, you know, loads of people, straight away, your hand went up. Now, same set of stimuli in that you've got green bars and you've got red bars, and you've got primarily two ranges of orientation, but in that set, the red bar pops out. You know, the difference is it's red, everything else is green. This one, everything is horizontal, one is vertical. So in terms of your being able to see that, to attend to that, because it wasn't the combination of features, then it was a much easier task. So we look instantly at the target because it's the odd one out. And whether I'd given you loads and loads of items or only five items, that still would have worked the same. And this is known as parallel search, where effectively you're searching them all at the same time. You're looking at them all, one pops out as different, that's fine. Whereas when that doesn't work, you have to resort then to what you did with the first one, which was serial search. And the reason I didn't show you the second one first, which would be the easier task, because that would have actually primed you too much to think, the features here I'm looking for, orientation and colour. So actually by priming you, by getting you thinking about it, can actually help focus your attention and improve your chances of doing the search faster. So we can talk about salience of objects. Objects that have high visual salience are those that tend to be capable of bottom-up attentional capture. So salience, we talk about, as a perceptual quality that makes some items in the world stand out from their neighbours. So in the single figure, in the displays where it was easy, they had higher salience than in the display where you had an item that was much harder to get. So, for example, things like bright colour or motion will give things greater salience. In the end, you're going to have, you know, you have to look at the relationship between the top-down goals and demands, that is, what's being driven by what you're looking for versus the bottom-up salience. So even though those tasks were the same and you had the same target, the fact that the stimuli were different and the salience was different affected your processing time, even though you knew what the task was and the task was the same. What may be the most salient object in one scene may not always be that in another. That what's important here is context often. What's the context in which the object appears or whatever it is you're looking for appears, that's going to really have a big effect on the salience and your ability to attend to it and then to perceive it. Okay. So we can actually look at how we see scenes in terms of their salience. And we can talk about it as salience mapping. So what we might do is we have a scene and we have a representation of the scene. And what we can do is explicitly look at how a human observer looks at that scene to understand better about what they regard as more salient. So if we look at something like this scene on the left, what you tend to find is if you look at the image on the right, that's a salience map. The lighter areas are those areas to which people most frequently attend. Or attend to most. So if you track where they're looking at, if you map between the two, the shore edge, where the water, the sea meets the sand, the clouds, the island, the bit round of the extension of the island there, they are the things in the scene that are most attended to. Whereas the areas in black, people don't tend to look at the sky itself, they tend to look at the clouds in the sky. They don't tend to look at the middle of the beach. If I gave you that picture though and said, what's the object on the beach? And I placed an object in the middle of the sand, then the salience map will be quite different because you would there will be A, something that is different there, and B, you are particularly attending to that. So top down, you're driving your viewing of that, rather than just looking at that and seeing where naturally you would attend from your learnt experience of the world. Now, what would happen if you gave that to someone who'd never seen the sea or never seen a beach or never seen a conjunction of water and sand? Might be another question. Be hard to find those people, but you know, you might find, you would expect to find different salience there. You can compute salience maps by a variety of algorithms. So if you want to look at automating and explicitly modeling this process, then the sorts of things that indicate or are good indicators of the salience there are things like contrast, line orientation. So the fact that the sea makes a line against the sand. So even if you had fairly simple vision modeling techniques, you could probably infer where a human might look. You can then assess them by comparing them to hand-tagged images to see, or eye-tracking data to see, what does it seem to be about that scene that they are mapping to. we can use those sort of maps to try and help us understand better about human behavioural data, but they're really focusing, quite often they're focusing on, if you only look at things like edges and contrast and colour and brightness, they are really only focusing on the bottom-up elements rather than the top-down elements. If I then had said, as I suggested, put an object on the beach, where, what is that object? You would need to have something like, to automate that, you'd need something more like a map, a body, a model, a visual model of objects that you could use to recognize that there is a separate object on the beach and what that object was. One of the things that increasingly is used in looking at this sort of area, looking at research, trying to understand how humans work in this respect, is eye tracking. Now, if I look at you, quite a lot of you, I can see from where you're looking that most of you are looking at either that screen or that screen. Some of you are looking at me, and the occasional person will be looking at none of those things. Okay. But I can see where you are looking. I can follow your gaze. And gaze following is a really, really important thing that we learn to do very young. And not only does it affect our perception of the world, it also is really critical to our development. So for example, the ability to follow gaze and to jointly attend to objects is a keystone in language. So learning to language and communication, that is a big thing. You know, you learn to refer to objects. You point to an object, the other person follows your gaze, they know you're referring to that object. There's a whole area of study of joint attention that particularly relates to how it develops, how it might not develop. And again, coming back to the example of autism, that is an area where people tend to be weak. So children with autism aren't as good at joint attention, which may have a knock-on effect later, for example, in their language development, which you wouldn't necessarily have predicted. Okay, so going back to eye tracking generally, eye tracking is what people currently use to see how humans view images and to infer what we're attending to and for how long. Now, it used to be the case that to use an eye tracker, have any of you taken part in an eye tracking study? Yeah, a few of you? Did you have the one where you had to have your chin on the rest and your head fixed in a position? Yeah, quite often, a lot of them are, basically the way they work is they reflect light off your eye, that the angle of which tells them where you're looking in a particular scene. Okay, so it's basic physics. But because of the way the things work, they often need your head to be still. So usually you had to put a chin rest, keep it still, so they can predict where your face is and where your eyes are. And then all they had to do is look at where the light reflects. Now, increasingly, people are developing technology that allows you to do that with much more freedom. Now, you can have the fact that you have cameras on a lot of PCs or iPads or whatever means that you can actually use data, particularly if you've got cameras, to work out where someone is looking. And that's interesting from the point of view of understanding attention, but it's also interesting from the point of view of how you might use that knowledge. So there's all sorts of ways in which that knowledge can be used. I mean, one example, really simple example, that we're not quite there yet enough to be able to do it reliably. Imagine if you could control your game playing by where you look. You know, don't have just a visual controller, you've got a Kinect, do it by eye gaze. You know, what could you do? How would it work? Yeah, that would be interesting. We're not quite there yet for things like that, but not far off. Okay, so going back to attention here. Eye trackers are mostly camera-based, require holding the head in place. What happens is when you're looking is, as I said, you don't tend to look directly at something and stay there. Your eyes tend to make what are called saccades. They're quick movements away and back. If you look at what's been looked at in a scene, what eye trackers record is the fixations where the eye comes to rest, and they indicate where the person is attending. So this is from the vision text, the Goldstein text, but it's actually taken from another paper. And the example they use, you can tell it's an American textbook because they're making a peanut butter sandwich. Okay, so if you look at where people look when they're actually making a sandwich, they look at the bread, they look at the peanut butter, which is the middle jar, they look at where they're buttering, they look at the knife, their gaze goes between the things in the ways indicated by the mapping there. Eye tracking also, as I said, one of the things people are thinking and starting to use this for is also to do things like model how people look at web pages. So one thing you can do is say, how usable is a web page? Okay, if you find a person is using a web page and, for example, they're trying to perform a task, maybe it's a tutorial or whatever, and what they're doing is looking backwards and forwards between two bits of information all the time. You know, you might infer from that they can't understand it, they're not sure what's going on, and they're just going backwards and forwards. Or if you find they're looking away, say you develop a tutoring tool, some educational software, which is my area of interest. Now, if you say, right, I've got, you know, a nice little tutoring tool here, I'll put some information on the screen, we'll assume the reader's going to read this and understand that they're going to do certain tasks. And one of the things you can do is you look and see where they're looking. So are they looking at what you intended? Are they looking out the window? No, are they completely bored and therefore not looking at the screen at all? Therefore, you probably want to get their attention back in some way. And that will be quite an easy thing to measure and a bit cruder than exactly where they're looking on the screen. But by monitoring where they're looking, you can then make all sorts of decisions about what you do. But also you can better understand how people process information. And then design layouts like web pages to make them more accessible, to make them more targeted, to make them better able to use. And if you look particularly at like the figure in the bottom, where people attend to in that figure is pretty much the heads of the two people. And that's the main places they will look. Okay, so with the rest of this week looking at attention, we're going to look a bit more at deeper processing of stimuli and orienting, filtering and selecting. But we're also going to look at things like change blindness and briefly at things like eyewitness misidentification and image salience and eye tracking. So these are some of the things we're going to talk about, is not only where does attention work, but how well does it work, and maybe where it fails to work. Because of the way it's designed, there may be some things that you miss. And it may be generally that's fine, but occasionally, you know, that throws up things that you wouldn't have expected. Okay, and the references, as I said, there's various references on this, but also on the web page. And I'll make sure to get these slides up. Okay. Thank you, and I'll see you on Thursday.
Check every single line, whether green one, to see which one was the odd one.
Well, you may or may not. Yeah.
Only enough, I didn't. What I noticed was strange that there was one green and one red one which were facing the exact same way.
And that was also. So that's good, because what you then did, you were using the features, but in a different way, because you'd already worked out they mostly look different. So you do a contrast there. Yeah.
I saw that one red and one green one was looking the same, and then I just had to check which of them was the old one.
Right, okay, yeah. So people use it in different ways, yeah. But it wasn't as easy as the other one, though, was it?
No, but it didn't take more than a few seconds. It took like 4 or 5 seconds.
Yeah, but you didn't see how many other people behind you took a lot longer.
Yeah.
You were, like, it was a group of you that got it, and then a whole load of you that was quite a while before they got it. Hi. Oh, yes. Damn, I forgot about that. Sorry. Okay. So what we'll do is on Thursday, unless there's a meeting before then, on Thursday at the beginning of the lecture, remind me, and then we can do that. I forgot that. I should have told someone. Remind me at the end of it to do that. But actually, if also, can you send me an email saying that you're willing to do that? Sometimes for some classes there's more than one, sometimes there's just one. Send me an email anyway and we can check it out. So if it turns out that actually I was supposed to get it done by tomorrow, then but anyway, yeah, send me an email, but also I'll we'll mail the class and ask them. Thank you for reminding me. Just go to an earlier one.
Just go to a different one.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Preferably the 4 o'clock rather than the 3 o'clock.
On Thursday?
Yeah, because the 4 o'clock, the 3 o'clock one's the bigger one. Yeah.
Okay.